Ready?
Ready.
Can you please talk some more about the Anandamaya Kosha, the Kanana Sharira? Okay, so if we look at the three bodies, the three Shariras, the Sukshma Sharira relate to the dream state, and the Stula Sharira relate that to the waking state. The Kanana Sharira is causal. The causal state to both of those other states. And so that means that the maya there, or the ajnanam that is there from the standpoint of the jiva, has in it unmanifest all of the things that are not functioning. Like, for instance, in the Kadana Sharira, the mind is in what we call an atisukshma state, very subtle. It's in its causal condition. It's still there. That's why when you, it's the same for samadhi, as will be seen. When you are in that deep sleep, there's an experience of that. And the experience of deep sleep is really one of an ananda plus ajnanam, you know. So that ananda maya kosha is the fullness or the wholeness of your own being. The sat, which is the existence being, which is the sat, which is chit, which is consciousness, is also that ananda, which is that which, and we've started saying sometimes, is that which is the most beloved, that which is most dear to you. That's what we mean by ananda, instead of some sort of a bliss, so to speak. So when you're in deep sleep, that means your mind, that is usually awake in the dream state and in the waking state, it's just in the waking state you have your sense organs operating. It is there as an adisukshma vritti. The vritti is still there. It's just not functioning. It's an unmanifest or causal condition. And so when that's the case, just imagine you don't have self-knowledge, but at a moment of happiness, say the buddhi, for instance, at a moment of happiness, kind of resolves into that ananda. It doesn't know the source of the ananda, the source of that fullness. But that's its experience. And it has that experience because a desire has been fulfilled, or you're walking through nature or something. And so there's a sukshma, a subtle shantavritti that takes place, which has for its content not nama rupas, not names and forms or activity, has for its content really the self plus ajnanam. And since the ajnanam, since the ignorance is there, you don't know what that ananda is. You have the ananda experience, but you don't know what that is. And it's also time bound. And so that's why it's called anandamaya kosha. It's because of the ajnanam that is there. And that ajnanam is the kadana sharira. So remember when we have the five koshas, the pancha koshas, and the three shariras? These five koshas fit into these three bodies. So the anamaya kosha is the stula sharira, the physical body. They're the same. It's just we're dealing with it a little differently. We're dealing with this physical body as a kosha, as something that covers, where there's an ahankara can land on that. And then for the sukshma sharira, you have the pranamaya kosha, the prana, the manomaya kosha, the manas, and the vijnanamaya kosha, the buddhi. These are all in the sukshma sharira, and included in that are the karmendriyas with the prana and the jnanendriyas, the organs of action, and the sense organs with the manas and the vijnana and the buddhi. So that's all, it's all talking about the same thing. We're just using it, dividing it up the pie a little bit differently because we have some different things we want to point out. So we have the anamaya kosha for the physical body, the other three koshas, the vijnana, manamaya and pranamaya for the sukshma, the subtle body, and anandamaya kosha for the causal body, because there's only the experience of ananda there without any knowledge. Experience of fullness there without any knowledge. So you have a sukhavritti, basically. But what's the real content of the sukhavritti? It's just the self, you know, as opposed to the content of the dukkavritti, that we don't give that to the self because there's no resolution. There's just various degrees of agitation which take place in the manas. So, I don't know what else to say about it. Okay. You don't either, I guess. I don't know.
I just have a thought on that.
Okay.
So the kosha means a place where we can make a mistake, an identity mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the subtlest form because it's so closely linked to the happiness and shanta.
That's true. It's the most subtle.
That's
Just like even each kosha is moving inward. The buddhi is the most subtle of the kind of the awake mind. Because the buddhi pervades and can objectify the manas and the prana, or the manas and the prana, and the memory. It can objectify, comment on, engage with all of these things. But the manas can't. The manas just receives vrittis from the five sense organs, and it has all the negative emotions, but it doesn't objectify. It doesn't have the power to objectify itself and comment on. That's the buddhi coming in.
Right.
And then so, and then the prana, you know, is below that, that doesn't have sentiency. That's just the prana and the karmendriyas, which then the buddhi can also objectify that. The buddhi is innermost before we get to the karma sharira. In the causal body, then there's no knower known there. It's because it's all causal.
Could some imaginations be considered like the ananda kosha happening?
I don't think so, because an imagination would be maybe closest to a dream state because the sense organs are not involved. But in an imagination, you can have that bliss.
Yeah.
Right? But when you're having the bliss itself, there's a resolution. The bliss doesn't have nama rupa. It's a resolution into the anandamaya kosha. Even for a moment.
Yeah,
that's how they look at it anyway. Does that make sense?
Okay.
When you say, "Don't take people inside, keep them outside," can you unfold that?
Yeah.
Does it mean to not take on other people's problems, not letting other people hurt you? Please explain. Well, that statement, "Don't take people inside," that's directly from Pooja Swamiji. He used it many, many times. What happens when he's saying that? It means you've kind of lost your objectivity. You know, there's something as painful as happened or whatever, and then that person maybe has some feelings or something negative about you, and they are there, that person is there who has their feelings, right? You don't have to take all of those feelings, you know, and that person's relationship with you inside as though you're carrying around inside of yourself. So along supplemental to that statement, don't take people inside, is be kind of the opposite, meaning to say, give people their space. They're allowed to have feelings. You know, let them have their feelings. Let them be who they are. They're their feelings. They have a right to have those feelings, you know. And you can let them be with their feelings. And not everybody needs to like you. What? No, not everybody needs to like you. They may not like you, you know. Let them have their space. You know? And that, just saying that, means that you keep them outside. You know, you don't. And another way of looking at don't take them inside is don't let this dyad form. A dyad means, okay, so you and the other person, the two of you are now inside in the psyche, quarreling or hurting each other, making each other feeling bad, and this whole world is going on inside, you know, because you've been hurt and this person hurts you. So now this dyad between the hurt person and the hurter, which is usually, you know, reciprocal. I'm hurting you and you're hurting me, and I'm hurting you and you're hurting me. And that we have that inside, living inside, going on and on and on in this kind of imaginal realm, creating a lot of pain. Instead, if you can keep the person outside, then you're here, that person is there, and they have some feelings which they have a right to have. they have a right to their space to be as they are. And then you, that gives you the space to be objective. You know, you can try it. I mean, it is really awful when somebody hurts your feelings or they don't like you or something happens like that. And then that's in, that whole situation is in, like an, we call it in psychology, an introject. Then you're walking around with this dyad inside of you, and it's as though it has its little life of its own that keeps the pain and the hurt going because you've got the, you've swallowed it. You've swallowed the dyad, which is you and the other. You know, and then you have to live with that. Just keep, why do you keep taking everybody inside like that? Just leave them outside. Because I used to always take them inside and suffer, you know. Keep them outside. Let them be. Not everybody has to like you. You know, let them have their space. Let them have their own feelings. You know, you have your feelings, let them have their feelings. I can't. Yeah, I learned it after some years. It wasn't easy. We tend to be a sensitive group. Yeah, these mumukshus. Yeah. I have a question from the class we had on relationships. For a mumukshu, is it important to live with another mumukshu, or is it possible to have a good relationship without sharing the strong one for knowledge or spiritual growth? I think it's definitely possible. It depends on your prarabdha, who you end up having a deep and close relationship with. I think the problem comes in a relationship, even if it doesn't involve being a mumukshu, but just being a person who has some interest. Your partner doesn't have to share that interest, but they have to be happy that you have that interest and support it, be very supportive. And when they're not, even if it's no matter what it is, say you have some love, it's your prarabdha, it's who you are, it's what you're doing in your life, and your partner doesn't want you to do that, then that's a problem. And that's a real problem. But what if they're happy that that you found something that's so meaningful to you and so important, and they love you and they care about you and they support that? Then I don't see why it matters at all. And once you have knowledge, it definitely won't matter. I never think about anybody as being a mumukshu or not a mumukshu. If they're a mumukshu, I think about them in terms of classes and that kind of stuff, and completing that desire, bringing that desire into knowledge. But if they're not a mumukshu, then I have very close relationships with people who are not mumukshus. It just never even comes up because their interests are elsewhere, and I have some of those interests too. Doesn't make any difference at all. You know? So I think the most important thing is that your partner really, really loves you and wants you to be happy and supports you in the things that you're interested in. That's the most important thing. And then if they happen to also be a mumukshu or a jnani, that's a nice thing. That's a plus. But I certainly do not feel that the person that you're with has to be a mumukshu. They just have to love you and be happy that you have something that's so meaningful to you. I think that is important. Yeah. Could even be something simple, like say you love to ski, and you're a skier, and that's so important to you and what you love. And your partner doesn't want you to ski. Well, what's that then? What are we going to do? Yikes. It sounds trivial, but it's not actually, you know. What kind of relationship is that? You're not interested in or in love with who you are and the things that are important to you. That's not a very good relationship. kind of a weird one. Since me, the Atma, is not an object free from time and space, Punya and Papa is not something happening to me. How can Punya and Papa be described in relation to me? It's not happening. There is no Punya and Papa for the self, just like there's no creation for the self, there's no mind for the self, there's no sense organs for the self. There's nothing but the self from the standpoint of the self. So you have to think clay pot. Clay pot means from the standpoint of the pot knows that it is clay. But from the standpoint of the clay, there is only clay. Right? Where's the pot? Really, honestly, where is the pot from the standpoint of clay? Because there's only clay. That's the satyamitya relationship. There's no dvaita, there's no duality in it from the standpoint of the self. So from myself, you know, if we think of this whole maya, think of it as a big, big, infinite dream, lucid dream that includes the whole, the entire universe. Oops. I just lost my place in my mind. Oh, yeah. From the standpoint of the universe, you know, all that duality is experienced and relevant. Within the universe, within this creation, there's so many laws, there's science, there's so many things, you know. And all of it, you know, is, from the standpoint of Ishvara, all of it is like an infinite conscious being. From the standpoint of the universe. But from the standpoint of the self, there is only consciousness. Because nama rupa, any type of name, oh, forget about the nama, that just goes with nama rupa. Any type of form really has got to be mitya. Because what is really only there is the substance. And the form depends 100% on the substance. That's why clay pot stands for any object, really. What is really there is the substance, and the nama rupa is a mitya form that has for its reality only the substance, whether it be clay or iron or whatever it happens to be. So with this whole creation, there is only, from the standpoint of the self, there's only consciousness, but from the standpoint of the creation, there's all this duality and each object exists and all of that, but it's all maya. So this maya is mitya. So the satya-mitya relationship is the whole Vedanta. Even when you get to the standpoint of just yourself as the conscious being itself is what is satyam. That is what is actually here. And that means no sense organs, no, you know, no body, no karmendriyas, no thoughts, no feelings, no universe. And there's the universe, and there's the thoughts and feelings, and there's the karmendriyas. So it depends. If I'm within the universe, then I'm within all of these laws. But from the standpoint of me, from the self, then as the adhishtana, as the truth of the whole thing, there's only me. Okay, so to have that meaningful, you have to actually kind of experience the reality of that, you know, by objectifying the body and the mind and the sense organs and all of the things that are responsible for this know or known relationships that we have, and realize that they're all objectified. You're aware of them. And so now you have to turn toward the awareness itself, because you have awareness, there's as though a subject-object thing there. These are all objectified, so you have to turn toward the nature of awareness only. So myself as awareness, what am I knowing? I only know myself because I'm self-effulgent, self-evident consciousness. There's not a subject-object relationship, there's just the knownness of my being, which is non-dual. And that knownness of my being, that self-evident nature of my being, the whole universe enjoys and becomes known. And then suddenly the jivas in the universe have little antakaranas and sense organs, which reflect consciousness. And so they walk around as knowers. But actually, they have instruments of knowing, like the mind and the sense organs. Those are instruments that give pictures to vrittis, right? Perceptions to vrittis, to thought modifications that are illumined naturally by consciousness. consciousness from its own standpoint is just consciousness, but from the standpoint of the vritti takes on that consciousness as though and becomes known. Known means, another example, it enjoys the self-evident nature of consciousness. It becomes known, but if you take the consciousness away, then it's not self-evident but on its own accord. It's self-evident because of its relationship with consciousness. So all of that punya and papa, you know, belong to the creation as does everything else and not to consciousness. So consciousness is free of all of the dreaded evils, punya and papa and guilt and shame and limitation and all of the good and bad feelings, all of the duality that exists within the creation. The nature of yourself is completely free of that. It's just the self of the creation, the conscious being from which this creation, Maya, manifests. The self is timeless, the Maya is beginningless. The Maya has for its only locus, really, the self, because there is nothing but the self. You know, so Maya is it like an incidental attribute of the self, meaning it doesn't bring about any change to the self. So your self is always pure, it is always free, it is never and can never be tainted or, you know, made less than or more than it is. It's not dual. So yeah. So hopefully, for me, there is no punya or papa. It belongs to the jiva. It is there in relative reality, you know, but not from the absolute reality of myself. As a jnani, as a jnani, do you?
Jnani, do you? Milk? Do you milkery?
Misery? Because it's starting to be talking about naked beings.
It looks like an M with a line over top.
Cry. Cry. Do you? Cry. Do you? Do you still cry?
Oh,
you
still cry. Good one. That's it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Very nice handwriting. What relation? Do you still cry? What relationship do you have with the spectrum of the mind's unpleasant emotions? Well, I suppose if something gets me, I'm certainly capable of crying or having any number of feelings. But I think the difference is from the standpoint of a jnani who's had some time to kind of assimilate your knowledge, you know, is that if these type of hurts, you know, or experiences rise up, then what I think is the best in what I do is I don't really do anything. I just accept them and let them be there and let myself just feel them, as opposed to thinking about them or trying to act on them or act out on them. Like, say that the reason that you're crying or feeling so hurt is because somebody has hurt your feelings or done something or hit some unconscious spot inside, and so you really had a big hurt from all of that. And then what do you do? Do you have a lot of thoughts start? Normally, I mean, I think what can happen is a lot of, like a nest of thoughts and feelings start rotating around that to actually make the whole problem bigger and create more kind of sorrow and misery because of the way that you're thinking about the whole thing, you know, and blaming and acting out and feeling badly, and now what's going to happen, what's going to become of me, and all of these type of feelings that can come. You learn, I think you learn is that your vairagya actually increases. You learn that that is not the best way to go. I think what's much better than letting your mind, sparklers sparkle off of this hurt, is to instead just, like in meditation we welcome it. Just be patient. Just let it be there and be with it, and understand what it is. You know, without building up on it or building a world around it. You know, as that becomes your center, that hurt becomes your center, and everything that you're feeling and thinking and doing is an expression of that hurt. And you can become very impatient, you know, in terms of what am I going to do now? What am I going to do about this? And all of these kind of feelings, it's really not the right time to be thinking in that way. What am I going to do now? You don't want to think, you don't want the one who decides what you're going to do now to be this very hurt emotion. You know? Mm-hmm. And so then what I say, and for me what it is I just sit with some patience and let it dissipate. Because if you're really hurt, it becomes like an embodied emotion. It's what we call an affect. It's there, embodied in your body, you know. And so then we have to be with that. We have to be with that emotion. We can do things. We can do inner child work with it, or we can just let it be there and see what it itself is doing, you know, without trying to push it away or pretend like it's not there. You just let it be and be patient, and then it will lift all emotions and all hurts and pains. They lift and dissipate, you know, especially if you aren't trying to create a new life for yourself based on emotional pain. Sounds silly to say, but I mean, we actually do that. You know, you have a deep pain, or somebody's really hurt you, maybe your partner or something, or somebody close to you. And so now everything's destroyed, and you have to build up a new life for yourself, and, you know, where am I going to go, and what am I going to do now? And it's all just imaginal sparklers coming off of the pain. Mm-hmm. So it really helps, I think, to just allow it to be some of your prarabdha karma. This is one of the harder ones. Something has happened. Just let it work itself out. We'll see what Bhagavan does with it instead of you trying to do something with it. You know what I mean? You do something with it by helping your body, helping to dissipate it, doing what is good for the body and you in reference to that pain, but not making life decisions or, you know, trying to talk to the other person when you're both wounded. You know, you can say something like, if it has to do with another person, you can say something like, okay, we're both really hurt and really upset, let's wait till it wears off and then see what's really happening. You know, it's really hard to, and sometimes not very meaningful to talk it out in the middle of the hurt, because you're both more or less delusional in the pain. Yeah. I have my favorite little saying, it's okay, you can be with me. Yeah. And then just let it be patient. I feel like patience is one of the great keys to shanti, is patience. Let Ishwar take care of things. We think we have to take care of it, we really don't. That's it. And I think even for us, like at this course, is to kind of experiment with that patience and see what Ishwar is going to do, because we want to make decisions or figure things out when we have no idea what we're going to do. But then I should try to figure it out. But you don't know, you know? And so we want to figure out everything before it's time to figure it out. But what if you're just patient and see how things unfold? Then you're kind of in Ishwar's time, which is much slower than the mental time, but you don't waste all of your time thinking about all of these things that you're just more or less just imaginal, rather than, you know, being grounded in the things that are here for you to think about now and the things that you have to do now. Or makes a huge difference. And I think dealing with your emotions by allowing them to be there and being patient with them and, you know, kind of respecting them and let the mind take care of it, take the care of itself, providing an environment for the mind to take care of itself. So just have to try it. I think if you try that, you'll see what I mean, is that there's something very healing about that, rather than acting out off of it. So that's my value, and that's what I do.
Can I ask a following question?
Sure.
It makes me think about I think it's Vavishananda who says sometimes that we can try to stay fresh in every meeting. But at the same time, sometimes we can see a pattern in someone, how they behave or how they act. And it can be very hard to stay fresh in a way that, you know, to not expect that to happen again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I also see a value of kind of protect myself if I see that, okay, if I go there again, that may happen again. Or maybe I should can't keep a distance from this person because she or he behaves often like this. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because then it doesn't feel like I stay fresh, but...
I think you can stay fresh, which means Swamiji was a master of that, and I know that Vagishananda is really passing on that message that Swamiji is such a master of. He always would say, like, take a person fresh. And he would say about himself, I just take a person fresh every day. You know, every day is a new day. Because the prior day they might have had a great big huge reaction. You know, they could have been a blast off they had, say. But the next day, he'll take them just fresh. And so it gives the people another chance. Because the truth is that this is the next day, and the mind is different today than it was yesterday. And behind it all, there's always the same self. And so instead of taking the person to be the mind, you take them to be the self, which you know very intimately, and they're dealing with their mind. You know, and so... give them that chance, even though you're aware of the past history, you don't forget. But the way that you respond to them is giving them the chance to be their better selves today, you know. And the thing is, if that person, say his family or whatnot, and is a big trigger for you, then there's inner work to do to even be able to do that. You know, so for most people, say they're not family where there's so much samsara in a family, you know, it's just full of all kinds of different things. Okay, so it's maybe harder to take the family member fresh because there's so much baggage, you know, so much things that are collected. But now that you have knowledge, you can practice that, where before it was even a possibility. Now you can practice it, always giving the person a fresh start. And then work on yourself to be able to do that, so that in fact, you can always take somebody fresh. You know what I mean? So don't look at it as something that that, okay, that's what I'm supposed to do now. I would say that's what you can grow into. Do it as much as possible. In many instances, you can do that. You know, and that means you're not carrying days and days and years of baggage, that you're looking at that person through that baggage. So it's a great gift to somebody to just be able to take them fresh. You know that about Swamiji, he'll always give us another chance. No problem. You know, that's a nice thing. But we have to grow into it. Yeah. That's what our life is all about. If you remember, sure. It's letting that emotional lag time, it's growing into your knowledge. Yep. Takes many years. But it's nice though. It's very pleasing. It's like a flower opening, you know. Your growth is like a flower opening, and every step of the way it's beautiful because you're maturing, you know. Your heart is getting bigger and you're able to handle more. But it's not an instant shaktipat type of thing. Oh, please talk about these two words, Kriya and Tantra. I can't. I don't know enough about these. Maybe Sky does. No, they're not my words. These are technical words, Kriya and Tantra. I don't have enough knowledge to say. Just only not enough knowledge to share. You know Kriya and Tantra. What would you say?
Well, Kriya means action.
No, I know, but it's a yogic term also.
Yeah,
type
yeah.
of yoga.
Yeah, it's in Kundalini yoga, Kriya means what would you say? Decisive action. Like almost like a ritual, something you do because you decided
to do it.
To do it.
It's a Kriya.
Yeah. So the yoga sets in Kundalini yoga are set, and they're called Kriyas because it's, you tune into them and you do them as you plan to do them.
Yeah.
And you've done it. And you do them for a specific result.
Yeah.
So I guess you could call the puja a Kriya also. Or it's like anything you do to with a clear mind for a specific result.
It's a Kriya.
Yeah.
And so in the Kundalini yoga, there'll be a number of Kriyas that they teach.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about Tantra?
Thousands of them.
Thousands of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Tantra, to my understanding, is the... Well, maybe... Do you want to answer that?
I was just saying also another meaning of Kriya in more traditional Kundalini yoga, or actually, you know, what all... Some people say all the asanas is coming from the body going into kind of a very speeded up Antakarana Shuddhi process. Kind of a clearing out of the nadi systems through the body, just suddenly, spontaneously going into certain poses that are highly purifying for the whole system.
And that's a different way of talking about Kriya.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People that are into traditional Kundalini yoga or that have an activated Kundalini process, they usually have this happening, and it can be everything from the body going into, like, let's say the Matsyasana, the fish pose.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly it just happens like that. You might be sitting in meditation, and sometimes even suddenly the body goes into a spinal twist without you. It comes from like a movement from inside, and sometimes in extreme cases it can be like coming out through laughter. Or through intense sobbing can also be
releasing.
Kriya. It's a release,
yeah.
of like age-old tensions that have been held deep inside.
Just to clarify, this is not the same thing as in Kundalini Yoga, as taught by Yogi Bhajan.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're two different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then there's Kriya Yoga.
Yeah.
What about Tantra?
Tantra, I would say, is the science of working with polarities.
With what polarities?
Polarities, like polarities coming to a whole, you know. In Kundalini yoga, they work very much with something called white tantra, which is working like with the masculine and feminine, like in a big, but in a it's non-physical and non-sexual. It's a meditation practice, but you're still working with those polarities and meditate together, like in certain ways. And then there's all other kinds. That's what I would say.
I would add to that, like, let's say that in Vedanta, we don't believe that any action is going to bring us closer to moksha. It's just preparatory things, you know. Tantra has the view that, you know, certain actions and practices is going to do that. You know, it bring you closer to moksha. So it's actually, sometimes people say that just the word tantra means kind of tools. You're using certain tools to come closer to moksha.
Yeah. And I think Vedanta would say those tools would bring you and help to bring antakarana shuddhi.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is the upayanishta that can facilitate. Yeah. Good. Thanks. Couple more. One more. Do one more. Yeah. Then we can. With reference to the scope of Shastra beyond the inner friend and a detailed analysis of the unconscious, what are the flaws, gaps, something of Vedanta in your eyes? What is Vedanta missing to thoroughly deal with and analyze complete emotional maturity of the person? I would say that when the one thing that we've added on, not to Vedanta in terms of the knowledge, I don't see any problems there. It's just that when the knowledge has to be taught in this time, in this arena, using examples and things that are relevant to us, along with all the regular examples like clay pot that we use. But we have to be sensitive to the use of language and all of these type of things to make sure that knowledge is transmitted as it's supposed to be transmitted, supposed to be taught. But what it doesn't have is much psychology. It has cognitive psychology. How attitudes and dharma, for instance, I mean proper attitudes in the world, gives a lot of shanti. Because if I'm behaving in the world dharmically, the way that I act and way I treat people definitely affects the type of shanti or peace that I have in the mind. That's cognitive psychology. We teach that all of us who are therapists, we use cognitive psychology along with other things. A lot of depth psychology also, but cognitive psychology has to do with your value system and how to be in the world in such a way that you have some shanti and others have shanti also. So that cognitive psychology we have, but we don't have in the Vedanta really, we don't have depth psychology. We don't understand the unconscious except in the most cursory way. Like they talk about raga, how does Swamiji say that? Raga dveshas that are, he has a word. That what it means that they're in the unconscious.
Kashaya?
No, kashaya was going to do, that's different. Kashayas are the things that if you're meditating, kashaya is a term that's used for meditation as a pratibandhika, as an obstruction, where you'll be meditating and then these thoughts and feelings will rise out of nowhere. They don't really have much to do with the current world at all. Those are kashayas. That's unconscious material, is what we would say, the unconscious material. And all they say, well, let those things bubble up and leave. You just remain passive and let them come and go. Whereas when we're dealing with psychology now, because Jung will say our unconscious is much more full than it used to be. The unconscious used to run, his example was that unconscious used to run like an underground stream. Now it has all kinds of boulders in it, you know, because the unconscious doesn't have all of its needs, kind of its instinctual needs on a psychological level, don't have proper places to land in the world. Like there used to be religions that all over the world that were segregated, you know. And so people grew up in one religion and they had their belief system, they had their God. They knew what would happen to them when they would die, where they were going to die, where they would go. They had a whole system, religious systems all over the world. But once we, you know, had airplanes, boats and airplanes and all this type of thing, these different religions all got contaminated by each other. I'm just making it very simple now, but the thing is that contamination eroded the Shraddha in the simple belief system that was there. And so the gods all came crashing down in a sense. And so your need for God, or for what happens to me when I die, there weren't answers that stood the test of time. You know, with the modernization, even with science, with all of these things, these beliefs that had become so taken to be so real, instead of taking them more mythologically, or they're taken to be so real, they kind of crashed. And that caused a lot of problems in the psyche. Broken families have caused a lot of problems in the psyche because the child depends upon that family structure to remain whole, you know, and protected. And when the family structure breaks, that's not an easy thing at all for a child. You know, so that was also a big loss. A lot of security was lost. And when divorce became so much, the home, the family, you know, that's supposed to kind of protect you. You know, it's what you have. You have your family. That keeps falling apart. So people, even nowadays, more people are divorced than together. And so how can anybody count on their family staying together? Even children, if you go to the schools now, most of the kids are from divorced parents. And so that creates a disruption in the psyche that then has to be, we need the means and tools to handle that in a way so that the psyche can remain whole and complete. And that wasn't necessary. It's only been necessary for the last 200 years or so. We didn't have psychology. We had different forms of the psychology, but not in the form that we have it now. So that's what needs to be supplied in our era. Even Swamiji, when he started out, he must have been around 42, and at least when I had met him at that time, any psychology was just nonsense. He had no interest whatsoever in it, and made clear that we all knew that he had no interest. But the Westerners that were there, you know, made him reconsider. Because we had so many issues, you know. So what is this, you know? But Swamiji's such an open heart and open mind that he just started studying it and asking all about it, who are the psychologists in the room, you know. Not just, I mean, myself, as I became a psychologist a little bit later on. But he really studied and asked questions, and he's so bright, you give him an inch and he takes a mile. It's like that. So he caught on really quickly and started knowing how to be with his students, understanding transference, you know, and how to handle that. So many things. How to be a good listener. He always was kind of a good listener, but to listen. You know, so many things he learned and understood. And I think the students really benefited from it also. And they needed it. They needed to have somebody who had some understanding of psychology, because we all have. a lot of things to deal with. So I'd say that's the main thing. I actually, all of the drishtantas, the illustrations that they use, and they're simple, they've stood the test of time, they're powerful, you know. And the Vedanta itself, the tradition of teaching it as a pramana is extremely important, and it's still alive. It's still alive and well. You know, Swamiji did so much to strengthen that tradition, because he taught so many people long-term courses, 3-year courses, and then he would wield the pramana in the most incredible way. So yeah, I think it's psychology, a deep understanding for you and your students. It's really important. Understanding the transference is important, you know, because otherwise, how are you going to handle all the projections that are coming at you? You have to know. You have to understand that. And also, I'll talk about this when we have a few days. I'll talk a lot about the transference, but just for now, there's also a very positive transference that comes, that actually is a very good thing, with a lot of positive, all of the positive that is really there in you and your unconscious is often put on to the teacher or to the therapist, and say you don't feel comfortable with that. So then you push that off or push that away. Or you act it out, which is as much of a problem. But if you can respect it without acting out on it or pushing it away, it's that transference is very healing, and the student who's projected whatever that is will in time take it back. They'll take back the projection and own it themselves. But in the meantime, if it's projected out onto the teacher or the therapist, then they have somebody, a good person, you know, whatever they've projected on, that they can count on and feel safe. And so as long as the therapist or the teacher understands all that, you can provide all of that just with patience and not acting out and being a good person, because you have to be a good person anyway. But you can be sensitive to that and let that process play out without you acting out. Like, say, for a man especially, it doesn't happen nearly as much as for a woman, but say the student falls in love, but madly in love with the teacher, because there's such a transference of so much love and care that's really brought about, especially in the teaching of Vedanta, when the love is so much, just so amazing, you know, that that'll get projected onto the teacher. And the teacher has to be able to respect that and allow it, you know, not push it away and not act out. Because to act out, one therapist, a Jungian therapist, said that acting out on that transference is like a rape of the soul. Because it's the soul, it's the deep psyche, really, that has projected that goodness and that love onto the other person. And that becomes very useful when therapy is taking place or teaching is taking place. It becomes like a funnel, like a channel, you know. But then the teacher has to be educated, or they can act out on the transference or their counter-transference, all this kind of stuff. So it's very important for teachers to understand on, have some of this psychology, you know. And then the other is the negative transference can come on the teacher or the therapist also. We always say it's better if the positive transference comes first, because then there's something that can keep the student or the client in the therapy or in the teaching because of the strength of the positive transference when the negative transference comes. You know? But that also, you know, you have to accept that and not act out. Because it's transference. You know, it's all unconscious material. So when that comes, and it's all the negative stuff comes, and we say as a therapist,
I'm waiting for you, Shiva.
Oh, I can't see.
Shiva's face came.
Don't worry, we're almost done. Yeah. Anyway, to finish that, when the negative stuff comes, the teacher, the student, how the language we use, which I like, is you have to metabolize it and get back something else, and that's very healing. Because the negative transference is expecting a certain response. You know, which is why it comes in the first place. It's expecting a negative response, and you get back, you take that in and get back something else. That's extremely healing. So I think for a teacher in this era, where there's so much, we have so much hurt, you know, and all of the things that are going on in the world for the last 100 years or whatever, 50 years. We have to know these things, because they come up in the teacher-student relationship and even the students among themselves. It's all there. It's nice to have some kind of education about it. And I'll try to explain some things when we have these few days. And I'll just give you the kind of probably the interest to do some reading and to take it seriously. It's a responsibility to be a teacher with something knowledge that this is this sacred. This knowledge is so deep, it's so sacred, it goes so deeply in ourselves. So it's not just about the knowledge anymore, because we have a lot of unconscious things that we have to be. We all have to deal with. All of us, me too. We all have to deal. We do our best. So if you have some education, you can do it much better.
Om Swasti Prajapyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishah Go Brahmane Vyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Bharahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om. Thank you.